the song and talked about what, you know, what the song would do and what was happening. And then he would come in with just, you know, I think each song is just wonderful and slightly different than what I expected.
Well, we've come a long way from the operetta style of Snow White to the rock sound of this film. I'm curious, musically speaking, do you have an input into these things, or do you leave that to others?
Well, in deciding that we wanted to give it a contemporary sound, then we went to David and then felt what would be really interesting would be to do a fantasy with a contemporary score. Trevor Jones, who also did The Dark Crystal, did the score, but he based his whole orchestration on David's music so that he could flow in and out smoothly and David's music would be part of the overall sound. And I think that worked really well.
David looked like he was having a ball.
I think he enjoyed it.
Really put himself into that role.
He was just terrific. He's one of these guys that's so professional and, you know, very straightforward, down-to-earth, good actor, always well-prepared on the set.
You think his music will bring in people that wouldn't ordinarily see a Jim Henson?
I think so. That was something we felt it would be, you know, David's own audience is quite wide. He's got a huge spectrum of audience. So it would be fun if we get some of the music people who wouldn't ordinarily come to a film like this, possibly.
You've mentioned 2 to 3 years on this. How much of your life have you had to give over to this project? Just speak to us from a personal perspective for a moment.
Well, I run a whole company of people in New York and London, so it's a tricky thing to tackle a film like this because it does pull me out of everything else for a while. The overall commitment is about 3 years. But a lot of the time, we're always working on a bunch of different projects. You know, during this film, we were producing Fraggle Rock in Toronto, Muppet Babies. We do as a co-production in Canada. We've done a couple of arena shows. There's a lot of activity. Sesame Street.
Too many things.
I like it all.
How much involvement do you have with those things, like Fraggle Rock and Muppet Babies? Do you oversee the scripts? Or?
Just in general, terms. I don't read all of the scripts of either of those now, but in both cases I was very active in setting it up and then left people running it. And in both cases I also would drop in on it periodically. Then for this film, my total commitment starts when, you know, just before you start shooting. We started rehearsing, I guess, about 6 weeks before we started shooting. And then for the shoot itself and then the edit, and during all of that time, I really can't do anything else.
The years of the peculiar physical contortions you must have to have gone through to operate the animals and creatures. What has that done to you physically? Do you have real strong shoulders? Are you stooped?
Let's see.
What toll does that
take?
Well,
when I have a coat cut, they tell me one shoulder's higher than the other. And I think that's true of virtually all of our puppeteers. We're all slightly lopsided from having done this for a great many years. But basically, it hasn't had any other repercussions.
Are all the creatures considered puppets, whether they're costume or radio controlled or whatever?
It's funny. We, particularly with Dark Crystal, we shied away from the term puppets or puppetry because it had sort of a connotation that this was a kidsy sort of thing. And I think it still has that connotation a great deal. But in actuality, all this stuff to me is puppetry. You know, because the term puppetry encompasses a whole wide range of stuff. And we used a lot of different techniques here. And it's hard to know what to call it. You know, Hoggle is this. I don't know if this stuff is probably in the press kit, right? So you probably have seen some of it, how Hoggle is done. You know, with this, it's a radio control mask. And it's hard to call it puppetry, and yet it is, I suppose.
Is that something you've always had to fight, making people understand that puppets aren't just for children?
No, I've just never really cared about any sort of categorization of any of this stuff. You know, I felt we should do whatever you need for a shot. You know, and it doesn't matter what you call it. You know? I mean, we use any mixture of techniques that will accomplish on whether it's, you know, video or film, you know, what you want to end up with.
When you consider,
I'm not a purist in any of this stuff. I mean, I would do anything to.
When you consider new projects, do you think about how in actualizing them you could, you know, push forward the state of the art and try new things?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think it's one thing that I enjoy because it's interesting to try to push everything forward a little bit more, and it can get certainly highly technical. It also doesn't mean it gets any better. Because the very, you know, at the heart of all of this stuff is very simple hand puppetry, you know, and that sense of performance, it has to start with that, you know. So, you know, some of the good performers in this film are some of my best people who have been working with me for many years.
We were noticing last night how charming the it was to see the manipulations of the creatures. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't necessary that we not see those human beings.
As a matter of fact, it made it a more... you could see the contrast of manipulation plus, and then the effect.
Yeah. Yeah.
It would be impossible to do this in the picture, I guess, because you're doing it totally fast.
Yeah.
Is there any forum for just having people come out on stage in black and manipulating things?
Oh, sure. I mean, there are all kinds of other puppetry, you know, expressions. But it's just that... You know, in a film like this, we're using specific techniques. But that's one of the reasons I wanted to sort of show this here, you know, because it is the art form of performance. It's a performance art, you know.
Why this now really instead of animation, though? This is not the age of animation and fantasy anymore. It's three-dimensional objects in fantasy.
Well, I feel, coming from it from a performer standpoint, I feel that you always get a much better performance in real time. If you have a gifted performer doing this stuff, it's very different from animation, which in animation you have to think things through at 24 frames a second. You have to break down an action and figure out where the stops so you have to end up with something that's intellectual. You know, you're intellectualizing this whole process, and it's very different from taking a really great performer, you know. Dave Goals, who did a lot of this stuff, is just a really good performer. Great sense of comedy timing. And, you know, with our characters, it's just like, I mean, these guys are just as talented as very famous actors. And it's even, you know, it's just as much a matter of timing and performance and acting. Even though they're, you know, the performance is sort of screened through all of this mechanics and so forth. But it's still, you got to start with a really great performer there.
Animators, too, describe themselves as actors. So
that's true.
That's a common goal.
Yeah.
But do you ever think that you're filling a void that's been, we've had since Disney died as far as family entertainment?
People sort of want to pull me into the Disney thing, and I sort of resisted. I don't know. I feel like we're doing a different kind of thing. And also, I think Disney as a company is doing, you know, it sounds like they're really getting back into their big fantasy films again, big animation films. I'm not looking to step in anybody's shoes.
But isn't that not a goal of yours to provide family entertainment when there is so little of it available?
I feel with our background and what we've been doing so far, that we have an opportunity to do some really good stuff, and I feel a responsibility to try to do, you know, great programs and films, because you know, no one's really doing what we're trying to do, or not many people are.
We have this foghorn going on.
No, just the idea of one thing. To jump back a little bit, we, you know, our work is seen so much around the world, you know, because with Muppet Show has been in, you know, over 100 countries. Fraggle Rock is in like 90 countries, and Sesame Street's been in over 100, 150, I think. So we built up a major audience all over the world, and I think with all of the things that we do, we try to do things that we feel are making a nice positive statement in the world, and we like to think that the work that we do contributes something here, to kids.
But when you're doing something like Dark Crystal or this, how much do you have to worry about the youngest element of the audience, whether it's going to be a little too strong for them?
I think we generally do stuff that we like, and you do things that serve the story. With Dark Crystal, there were certainly scary elements that might be frightening to a 2-year-old, maybe a 3-year-old, but it had a PG rating. This film will probably have a PG. I'm not sure.
When you saw this film.
But it'll probably be PG just because of scary chases and things like that. I don't think there's anything in here that will hurt anybody.
A little toddler sort of in harm's way might be disturbing to youngsters. I mean, throwing the kid up, kind of having him surrounded by goblins. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He loves it. He loves
it. Well, we almost had the goblins throwing this kid back and forth. We said, no, we can't do that. But I think basically we were portraying these as the villains. And
how old was Toby when this was shot?
Just over a year. He was about 13 months, I think.
That does seem to be one thing you have in common with some of the early Disney films, I mean, aside from all the differences, and that is that you don't mind. Oh, like Sundance, I guess. I mean, you don't mind showing the really scary things. There is always a dark element, and that seems to make, it seems to provide a tension that a lot of stuff for younger audiences really doesn't have.
Yeah. I think it's certainly is true. It's what, drama is made out of, and at the same time, I think we try to temper it and not do, there's a lot of kinds of violence that I wouldn't do in a film. For instance, just little things like the climax of this film. In many ways, we needed a battle scene, between the goblins and our guys. But we didn't, these guys are carrying these terrible weapons all the time, which they never use, if you think about it. So just in order to have a battle scene without having a scene where people get their heads lopped off and things like that. So we ended up, coming up with this concept of the rocks sort of, rolling and driving the goblins out, which was kind of a humorous, solution to a battle situation. Because a battle does emotionally serve a great purpose in a film like this, You get this sort of feeling of a major confrontation between these forces and these forces, and if you think how often that is used in a film, it's a cathartic thing, to hit that point, the climax point of a dramatic structure, and so it becomes you have to sort of think of other ways of getting there without going through normal violence. And
there seems to be a dual ending to the film. I mean, on the one hand, Sarah realizes that she needs to put those childish things away and to understand that maybe they have a limited value. She shouldn't hide in that world. But at the same time, of course, the creatures promise to come back, and it'll make that sort of party that she has with them.
Yeah.
I mean, what finally is that mistake?
Well, I think we've talked a lot about it, and of course you analyze these things to death when you work on them. But the feeling was just that we didn't want to end up saying you have to put away the things of your childhood. We didn't want to leave the statement of you've got to leave fantasy behind when you grow up, and we wanted to say that that the elements of fantasy are always available to you as an adult, as you grow up. It will always be there when you need it, sort of thing.
But why does she?
But at the same time, you've got to grow up. I mean, you can't hide in it. You can't withdraw and stay, because the film sort of starts off and she's kind of doing that.
So to have a realistic sense of their value.
Was the reaction to or the difficulty of the Gelflings, did that make you, or inspire you to say, I'm going to use human actors in the next one? Do you think that was a necessity, that people expected that human element? I know it's not possible in Dark Crystal.
Partly. I think with the Gelflings, we had ended up choosing a physical design of those characters that made them very difficult to manipulate and to get a very wide performance from them. I think it doesn't. I wouldn't rule out doing a film with all creatures. I think it can be done, but the way we chose it and Crystal with those particular main, you know, leading characters, we've kind of painted ourselves into a corner, I think. You know, it's funny, in looking back at this, this is not what we're talking about, I'm sure, but in looking back at it, I think at one point Brian had come up with a design for them which would be quite elfish, and had we done that, I think we would have had a great deal better performance out of them, and the film would have had a, but it would have changed the whole kind of film it was too. So interesting.
Do these kinds of options, decisions, and things sometimes keep you up at night? Because so much is riding on productions, of course. And does it ever threaten to just become an oppressive burden on you?
No, I take things lighter than that, I suppose. No, I don't. I don't stay up at night worrying about it. You make decisions and you live with it and go with it.
What was the budget on this one?
I don't think we're saying. We came in on budget and on schedule. This whole experience was one of the most trouble-free of a major project I've ever had. It really was a joy from beginning to end. I don't think to talk about budgets is ever. It never accomplishes you anything because it's always ridiculously expensive and. You can't look at any movie and say, was this worth that much money? It never feels like it is.
How about moving past Kermit and Miss Piggy at the wedding? Are we going to have another film with
We're talking about another Muppet movie, yes. So there probably will be one at some point, but we haven't gotten specific on it. Frank's over there doing Little Shop of Horrors right now. He's been shooting that, and my son Brian is working that shoot, too. And he's been shooting that film since October.
Where is that happening?
They're shooting over in Pinewood, and in London. And it's looking absolutely stunning. It's for Geffen people and Warner Brothers.
Other than the Muppet,
TriStar doesn't want to hit it. Anyhow, it's going to be a wonderful film.
Might you do?
What? Shh, nothing. I didn't say.
Might you do some other G-rated? For the young audience with new characters or anything like that, or is it easier to reach them through TV now with Fraggle Rock and that?
Yeah, it's an aggravation, the whole thing of children's films. I think Follow That Bird was really a nice picture, and G-rated, and a G is such a, you know, you can't make it. I don't think you can do a successful G-rated picture these days. I mean, not spend any money. Because the kids won't go. You know, it's
the kids won't go or the parents won't take them, right?
No, it's the middle kids that won't go. It's the kids, the 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. Those kids are not going to be seen dead in a G-rated picture. You know? And it's stupid. I mean, we've boxed ourselves into a situation where you can't make a movie for kids, you know, for little bitty kids. You cannot do it. And so those kinds of projects are going to get shoved onto television these days, which is okay. I can see she's moving in on me now. Sorry, I didn't mean that.
But will you try to reach that middle group?
Most of our work in that area will be for television. Yeah.
You've been quoted before saying that you're very good with characters and personalities, whereas you thought Lucas might be a little bit better with, with plot and plot structure.
Yeah. Right.
What exactly were his contributions?
Basically that. George worked a great deal on the story and the story structure and the casting and all the pre-production stuff. And then I love shooting. I love the process in the studio. I really have a lot of fun doing that. And George loves post-production. He loves the editing and everything you can do, manipulating the film after it's finished. And so it was a nice balance. I think we worked quite well together. So it was fun.
Would you ever be interested in directing a film with all human actors?
I wouldn't rule it out. I don't know. I don't.
Would that
have
be
any...
more challenging or more difficult for you?
Hitchcock said they're like puppets.
It's two different things, you know. And even directing this film, where, you know, I had sort of my people doing creatures, and that's one kind of thing. And then working with Jennifer and working with David was something quite different. And I enjoyed both of them. You know, it's both processes are really. Quite different.
Is that hard to balance?
It's what a director does. You know, it's the job. But you know, in working with people and working with Jennifer, and she really is carrying that whole film, and, you know, and her emotional line has to be right all the time, so you have to sort of constantly be thinking about, you know, what happened before, and, you know, what is her attitude right at this point, and how would these things hit her, and all of that sort of stuff, and how you, you know, pull that, that total line from beginning to end of the movie together.
Excuse me, one last question, and then we're going to have to break.
That's when you heavy. Saw the movie for the first time, was there any point where you forgot that you had made the film and just got really into it?
In a picture, I think with any film I've ever worked on, it's years before I'll be able to see it. You know, I can't see it. You know, the first time I see it, I'm always, you know, terribly upset. I'm emotional. I just, you know, I can't figure out whether it's doing what I wanted to do, and I'm not seeing it. You know, I'll be able to look at this picture in about a year or two.
Can you tell by watching the audience as they watch the movie?
A little bit. You know, I'm so much in the process of still working on it, you know, and so you're only aware of the things that aren't working well enough, and you're always trying to make them better and improve them. So you're only seeing the things that aren't working well. But I think it's normal. So. Go ahead.
I was impressed with the fireys were your favorite part of the film. Is that true? And also on the same basis, was there one piece that was just more difficult to shoot to get the final result?
I think the fires were one of the most difficult sequences to shoot. I wouldn't call it my favorite section, although I did like it. Let's see, is there a favorite section? The favorite might be that song, David's song in that Escher-like maze at the end. I loved that. I had a lot of fun doing that. The scenic people, Elliot Scott, you know, was just such he's a wonderful scenic designer. And he did such good things, just, you know, ingenious uses of sets. You know, that first long corridor that Sarah is going through is the same corridor that the slashing machine is chasing him through, for instance, you know. Just little things like that, you know, just by taking that same piece of set and putting some top pieces on it and lighting it differently.
Maze at the end, that the perspective thing, what's the get that from? I'm trying to think of the artist who did that.
Yeah. M.C. Escher.
Yeah,
he's a German, I think German or Swiss, I guess German graphic designer. It's funny, I've loved his stuff for years, and his whole sort of turning perspective every which way. I've wanted to try to do it in a movie for a long time, and we kind of found a reason to try it here.
So you just tell the set designer, I want to incorporate this kind of thing.
We had an art director whose major responsibility was trying to figure that thing out and how to shoot it. And most of it was done, we started with a model, and then you work with that model and with storyboard artists and try to figure out what you can do.
You must feel like you're in the world's largest toy shop.
Oh, it's, you know, directing a film like this is, you know, it is certainly the most fun job there is. So, and I think I've heard other directors say similar things. It's, you know, on camera.
Yeah.
Is that you or Jones that came up with that bog of stench, the thing?
The bog of stench. That
was Jack of Jones' thing.
I think, yes, I think.
Testing, testing.
Yes, she's with Warner Brothers now.
Okay. Cheryl Henson, 3, 2, 1. Hello and welcome to The Green Room. I'm John Tibbetts, and coming to you this time around from Dallas, Texas, always a mobile location, I'm interviewing Cheryl Henson. Yes, the name Henson sounds familiar to you. We're going to have a chance to get to know the daughter of Jim Henson, of Muppets fame, most recently with The Labyrinth Out. Cheryl, we've just met. I'd requested an interview with you because, in addition to finding out about what family life is like with your father, I wanted to find out more about what you are doing in the area of show business. You're traveling with your father, Jim Henson, for Labyrinth. What are your functions right now? Are you helping to promote the film?
Now really is a number of different things, and it's very difficult to pinpoint exactly.
Okay. You had indicated you indicated you had worked on the film then itself. What did you do?
I started off working building goblins, and I built goblins for about 6 months, and the goblins' costumes are very elaborate, and there are a lot of strange little details and
Trying to imagine the job description. Building goblins would suffice.
Well, then I worked on the Fieries, which is the pink-bodied dancing creatures. And there are a number of us working on building the creatures, and then I was working on dancing them also. And we rehearsed that for about 3 weeks and then shot it for about 3 weeks. It was quite technically elaborate. Number.
Have you been this close to any of your other father's films?
Don't you want to hear everything else I did? We did all these little things.
go.
Well, we did doing masks for the masked ballroom scene, if you saw that last night, the fantasy scene, fantasy ballroom. And there are a number of us making masks for that. And then I also danced right way in the background on that. That was fun. Also working on the junk people, the characters that carry all of their worldly possessions that have become junk on their back. And making a lot of bits and pieces and sticking them all together. The whole building, the whole movie was a very long, elaborate process, and was very much of a team effort of piecing everything together. And
were you working with your hands or on the designing aspect of these creatures?
Working with your hands is the designing aspect of these creatures.
Well, for example, what are the substances that you're working with, natural or otherwise?
Most of the characters are sculpted first in plasticine and then cast in plaster with this silicone and then cast in a lightweight foam. We then make a fiberglass skull that foam lays on top of, and then the radio control, very much like a brain, sits inside of that skull and operates the different portions of the face.
So the operators crouch in the lower two-thirds of the body, as is the case with Hoggle. For example,
it's not that they're crouching. The face is like a mask where there are 18 to 21 servos, radio control servos, inside of the face mask.
What is a servo?
A servo, it's a motor with a single axis. And so for any complex movement, you need a number of these in order to get the full rounded motion that you would get in an eyeball or something like that, because a servo only operates one axis. So this mask is worn by an actress who's a little tiny person, and the four people who are operating the radio controls of the face sit on the side and watch her. They're not crouched. They're sort of way over to the side, either watching the monitor or else actually watching her and seeing what her point of view
is. Extensive preparations to coordinate then the person inside the suit,
yes,
as well as the radio operators.
Yes, they have to rehearse for long, long time. Every major dramatic scene, every single word has to be worked out, because what happens is you have one person operating the mouth and doing the voice, someone else doing the ooh sounds of the voice to get the lips to go forward, and someone else is doing the eyes and the eyelids, and someone else is doing the eyebrows and other portions of the moving face. And so it's very, very complicated, and little things like a shrug and how your eyebrows, and if you roll your eyes, lift your eyebrows, sort of lifts one side of your mouth, and the actress is shrugging all at the same time. This is such a complicated move, and it takes forever to work it out, and yet it goes by in a fraction of a second up on the screen. And the thing is that if you do it right, no one ever notices, because it's just natural. And if you do it wrong, everyone says, gee, that was a little funny, you know, that didn't really work. And so it's a much, much more complicated process to get something to look realistic.
How much of your own life did you devote to this project?
I worked on the film for 1 year. I worked on it from September to August. We finished shooting last August.
Now, is this what you were doing for a living, or was it a question of helping out Dad?
I just graduated from university, and it is a fascinating project. I worked on Dark Crystal before I went to school, and I enjoyed that very much. And so coming out of a strict academic university was very nice to sort of go back and to build things again. I really love to build stuff.
Have you lived mostly in this country or in Great Britain?
I've always gone to school in the United States. I lived all during the summers for the 5 years of the Muppet Show in London. Then for the Dark Crystal, we shot in London. And I took a year and a half and worked on that. And then I took a year and a half over the course of Labyrinth and lived over there. So mostly in the United States, but I do feel very comfortable in London now.
5 children to the Henson family. You are where in the chronology here?
I'm the second oldest.
I'm not supposed to ask you about your family?
Oh, sure. You're welcome to. I suspect that's why I'm here, right?
Well, I've got to wonder, though, what it's like growing up amidst a household that must be sometimes quite chaotic with creatures and designs and blueprints and plans, and Dad's away a lot. And
we never really had the puppets inside the house. When I was born, our house in Washington, D.C., my father's workshop was inside the house, but we were only there for about 2-3 years. And after that, the workshop was always separate from the house. We didn't tend to have that much merchandising or characters in the house. And so when you say that, it's a slightly false picture of how we lived.
So there was an attempt then to maintain more of a normal domestic hearth.
Yeah, it's quite a normal family life, I'd say.
Yes.
He wants to ask a question.
So you were, when you were born, he was still doing Sam and Friends.
Yes.
This incredible business that became Jim Henson is literally the course of your life.
Yes?
There are pictures of my parents. Excuse me. Start again. My parents started working together, and they'd been working together for about 4 years, for longer than that, before they got married. And then the kids were always around the productions. There are photographs of my sister and I in baby carriages over on the side of the set during Sam and Friends and stuff like that, because it was a live show. If you can't get anyone to take care of the kids, well, then they just have to come along. And
not only live, late night.
Late night, right. Yeah. And so we've always been in and out of the workshops and in and out of the studios and stuff. It's very
strange. Were you aware, as you were growing up, that Daddy was becoming a huge success? From local TV to the most successful syndicated television program in history, that's quite, over the course of a lifetime, your lifetime, quite something. Were you aware that something incredible was happening to your parents and their work?
How to answer this?
Of course, if you're surrounded by it all the time, you really didn't have an anti-environment, in a sense, to compare it with, I guess.
Right. There's... does not seem particularly extraordinary that it became successful. He's always been working on projects, and they've always done very nicely. And I think it's a pretty natural progression. When The Muppet Show became as wildly successful as it did, when you're in the middle of doing something, it's hard because it's not really, I'm not going to say this right. When you're in the middle of doing something, you don't really notice whether or not it's that successful or not. When you're in the middle of it, that's merely what you're doing. It's not till afterwards that, looking back at it, that it becomes extraordinary. Or when you go into a restaurant and someone recognizes your father, then it becomes extraordinary. When you see that, when you go on vacation to the Caribbean and you're up in a mountain town and they're watching television and they're watching Sesame Street or Fraggle Rock, then it's extraordinary. When you know that the Muppet Shows got on 134 countries, Sesame Street was in 94, Fraggle Rock is up in the 90s. To me, the most extraordinary thing about the success of the Muppets is the international aspect of it and the amount of influence, not influence, but that these characters are actually known by little kids all over the entire world. And that, to me, is the most phenomenal thing about his success.
Who among the family members has maintained the closest contact with the business itself?
As you know, there are five of us, and they're different ways of staying in touch with the whole setup. And all of us are part of it and come in and out of it to certain degrees. My older sister is with Warner Brothers, and she stays in close contact with my father on just about everything. They discuss all the projects that he's doing. But she also maintains her own lifestyle out there and works on her own films and stuff like that. My brother, again, comes in and works on my father's films. My brother is Hoggle, plays the voice and the mouth of Hoggle in this. But he's also done a number of other films for different people. He's done about five films now. But if my father needs him to come in to do something, he will hire him and bring him in. He's a very good puppeteer.
He keeps it as a fairly professional, strict business relationship then?
I don't think there's any way to keep it a purely strict professional business relationship. We're all very close. But I also think that it's important to work outside and then work back inside.
Has he provided all the training you need for this, or did you also take courses in schools that helped you?
Me specifically, or my... I couldn't imagine anyone taking courses in puppetry if you can
strictly
work,
OJT.
Right, if you can work in the workshop and perform, because there's no better training than doing it.
But when did you start this? I mean, were you working on puppets when you were very young? And
I think that all of us have always done a lot of craft work and a lot of artwork. I use my hands a great deal. I do sculpting and a lot of sewing and a lot of different sorts of craft things that all combine to do the puppets quite easily.
So you've got an awful lot of background in this whole business. Have you yet chosen then a specific direction to go professionally yourself?
Not specifically, no.
Is it a question maybe of having too many options available? That's not exactly a problem all of us have, at any rate. But you're growing up in a family with a high visibility, I suppose, inevitably. Mm-hmm. Here I am sticking a microphone in your face, for example. Does that ever become a problem day to day?
I don't know how to answer this. I think that my father enjoys the pleasure of being successful without having too high a visibility, because since it is puppets, many people love his work but don't necessarily recognize him. And in a way, that's very nice, because you get you know that the audience is appreciative and really enjoys what you're doing, but you don't really have to deal with crowds of people, and you don't have to worry about it that much. You can really stay yourself in your own life and then do your work for your audience. And I think that many actors don't have that freedom of having their own life separate from the professional life. And I think puppeteers really do. I think it's quite nice.
When you were younger, didn't you have a lot of school friends that wanted to come around and see the Sesame Street characters? Or
when I was much younger, Sesame Street was only just starting. They did the first pilot when I was in first grade, and I actually, our whole class stopped and watched the pilot that time. In general, I've always kept my own life quite separate from the business life.
What was your feeling when your whole class was watching your father's big project?
I really hope they'd like it.
Well, you're sort of on the line, aren't you, in a sense? You're the forward observer out there in the school crowd.
I'm the forward observer, but I don't really feel like I'm on the line. Mm-hmm. But I do always hope that people like
it. As a second grader, were you able to watch Sesame Street and not see Ernie and say, gee, sounds just like my dad, or did you know it was your dad? Were you able to get into Sesame Street as a child? Did you watch it?
I mean, Ernie sounds a lot like your father.
Yeah, I always considered myself much too old for Sesame Street when Sesame Street came on. This has to do with being a precocious
swinging
girl.
Sophisticate.
No, it has to do with knowing all of your ABCs really well. I think it wasn't until a couple of years later that I really started to love Sesame Street because of this, mostly the short films and the style of the artwork in it. It really covers a wide variety that other television shows for children really doesn't. And I really enjoy it, but that I never watched it as an educational thing.
As far as your younger brothers or sisters, though, have they ever had that kind of confusion that Greg was talking about?
I don't think so, no.
What about reacting to the characters when you were really little, like maybe when Sam and Friends was on? Did you see them as just part of Dad's work, or were they friends, rivals, toys, or...?
They were certainly not friends and rivals. I think that it's very easy to make assumptions about relationships between puppets and real people. A great deal of it is a lot of fun and is quite valid, that puppets are an extension of the personality who's operating them, and this is what gives them the depth and the warmth of the individual characters. But I think that people often try to make too big a thing of jealousies or rivalry or loves or passions, and that doesn't really come in to dealing with the puppets. I think that that is a, it's a very un, it, yeah, it's a very unprofessional sort of dealing with puppets. That's, those are the loony bin pictures.
I didn't even hear what you said. Since I didn't hear it, I'm not so sure what it was.
No, we're.
Does it take away some of the magic then when you know all the tricks and exactly how it's done when you're little? Can you still watch it and get involved in the story making?
I think that to me a lot of the magic always has been the making of them and how they're operated and how they're made and the layers that goes into these different characters. And not only the technical layers of building them, but also the layers of developing the personality, working through the rehearsals. Stuff like that actually, in so many ways, is as magical, if not more magical, than simply looking at it and saying, oh yeah, I believe that. There's something...
Fair to say your mother has had a greater effect on you than your father? I mean, she must be a remarkable person. She's been an integral part of the business for a long time, raised five children... Is you think your mother's gotten the credit she's deserved? We talk about nothing but your father. So.
My mother's
also
a
look a great deal like
her. Oh, I do, don't I? I didn't know you knew her.
I don't know her, but I've seen enough pictures ever to know you look a lot more like her and you look like a guy with a beard.
My mother is extraordinary. She's a really, really wonderful, wonderful woman. When I see families with three or four kids around, you know, train stations and airports, I'm really amazed that my parents managed to get five kids sort of to full age and have them all be relatively okay, you know. That in itself is extraordinary. She's great. She's worked a lot with my father. While we were at the height of our rambunctiousness, she had her hands full with us and pretty much pulled away from the company. And then as we were grew up, she moved back in and is now working a great deal more.
So that's the shift now. She is back involved with operations.
Yes and no. Yes.
So once again,
you need a clearer answer to that, don't you?
Well,
I'll just say yes. Sure. Yes.
I guess the generalization would be it is now a completely a family endeavor. Everybody is involved.
No, I would not say that. I would say that I'd say that it's a really fun company and that it's a large company. There are over 100 people working in it and that from time to time all of the different family members work with it and really enjoy it, but that none of us are really... I would not call it a family company. No.
As far as your mother is concerned, then, what kinds of activities is she most close to? What,
right,
I don't know about her. What does she do?
Oh,
what is her
great
input? Uh-huh.
I don't know.
Voices, too, huh?
No, actually, no, she's never... My mother's never done voices. Back in the really early days on Sam and Friends, they did all of the comedy sketches to records. And when they didn't use pre-recorded records, my father would go in and cut just the record for that evening, the way they would do the, you know, that old, the real fats ones, right? Okay. And he'd do the funny voices and stuff, but my mom never really did voices, so I was just puppeteered.
Mm-hmm. Was she a disciplinarian? You mentioned that your father never loses his temper. So who was in charge of the...
I don't think we had all that much discipline, particularly. Sort of.
You mean discipline problems or discipline, period?
No, discipline problems. There really haven't been much trouble. I think that when you have five children, people tend to monitor each other as much as the parents do. And it's the old story of the older ones working with the younger ones. And we've never really had a problem.
So. Can you recall? Go to one parent as the other when you had a problem?
We're really getting into the dynamics of the family relationship. Well, there is one dynamic I'm curious about, which is, have you ever been used as a sort of testing area? Have ideas been thrown at you at specific times where, will kids go for this, basically? And have you had input over the years?
I'd say definitely that all of us have. That my father, when he gets an idea, he really loves it. And he loves to talk about it. He loves to bounce the idea off of a lot of people. And because his family are the people that are immediately around him, we've always had ideas bounced off of us since we were tiny.
Do you remember any specific ideas for characters that came out of the house?
Some specific examples then?
Oh, no. No.
Maybe the instances are so numerous. That's the point, huh?
It's more of just an easygoing relationship of talking about what the projects are. I mean, even now, a lot of what I'm doing is that sort of a thing of just sort of, you know, I can't explain this. Yeah. You're going to have to cut
as you travel.
Out because I'm so dreadful.
Well, as you travel, however, and people are asking you questions like we are, what are some of the things that you most enjoy talking about or most enjoy wanting to talk about that we don't understand?
This is the first time I've ever done an interview.
I don't believe you.
It's true.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, but you've traveled enough that you've been available.
Yes, but there has